So if the panelists could come up to the table, I think we only have about 3 hours or so for questions.
So, Marvin, I just had a little conference getting late, and we just had a wonderful session. So instead of having a session after the session, I mean, let's just be it. So we'll go more in addition to the discussion of this wonderful panel. People want to interpolate forever just for the rest of the conference. So that's great.
Are books that do what you're calling for and reimagine the book form within an information aesthetic. And I just mentioned one of those is Mark Danielewski's House of Leaves, which is trying to quite self-consciously extend the claims of the print book in a digital age. So there are lots of examples of that as well.
I hate nostalgia, this is not a nostalgic project. I think that one of the things that happens with every medium when other media come along is that the new media close off certain spaces for the established media and open up certain possibilities. So one thing that the book had as its onus for very many years was it had to carry the whole of the sort of cultural accumulation. Our information database had to reside between pages in libraries. And with the web, that has freed the book from bearing that responsibility alone, opening space for a certain level of play. And I think that, you know, just as there's no reason not to paint today, there's no reason not to make books and not to make new books. And one of the things that I really appreciated with Lev at the sort of opening reception for this book commented that he thought, you know, maybe we've done something to create a new operating system for the book. And so, no, not nostalgia.
I also have an answer which comes to the same conclusion but from a completely different starting point, which is, you know, I was originally trained to be a romanticist. I'm all for nostalgia, but I would put this slant on it that true nostalgia is nostalgia for a past so deep and so other. It has a kind of disruptive effect now. My concern is that we're not being nostalgic enough, that we are not being archaeological enough, to use that word, I refer to Bill Gates as the chief innovator of his company, and as you may know, his chief defense against the monopoly charge was that Microsoft is the innovation company. That phrase has now become the leading ideology of post-industrial business. That's why you hear the economist of the 1940s, Joseph Schumpeter, cited so often for his phrase, creative destruction. All our companies now believe in creative destruction, but with the emphasis on creativity here. Now, I think, and it's a very good other mode, for, especially for those of us in the humanities and arts who are interested in information technology, is sort of contest or resist that shallow notion of creativity, of workplace 2000, of everything millennial and futurological, with the deep appreciation of the past. Can we confront the future with a past that is so deep and so disruptive and so other that it has the force of the kind of new that we're talking about? So I would say even go beyond the nostalgia for the book form. Let's go all the way back to carrying rocks around in our pockets for tokens of things. The kind of material object, in other words, that Kate was referring to in her talk.
Pockets full of memories.
Well, okay. So can I answer?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, in relation to, I guess, part of your question, which was about me, and I'm sorry for my sort of, you know, delivery because of a cold. Well, if you remember, like in the middle of my page, I sort of said, you know, we can situate kind of in, you know, infostatics or information culture on a number of dimensions. And of course, I agree with you that information access, right, or information presentation was always, you know, was always kind of a dimension of culture. And in fact, you know, if we look at most cultural objects or most work objects, it's very rare that we find something which would only exist, you know, at the kind of extreme polar dimension. So, for example, we can say that maybe, like, you know, maybe a schedule in the airport would be like as pure example of pure information delivery as you can get, even though it's still graphically designed, but its rhetorical function is probably very minimal. And then on the other end of the pole, you would say, okay, the image of God in traditional culture is probably not to deliver you information, it's probably to make you, you know, tremble, experience transcendence, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What I was trying to say, and it's so difficult, you know, that's why I keep, like, you know, defining my own terms, is that when we created new computer interfaces, they were mostly created for working with information. So that's why you think like you have things like multiple use of data. You know, if I have an image representing God, I probably don't want to represent, you know, God in multiple, you know, multiple windows, because then people will be doubting, right? You know, but if I'm looking at the object and I want to manipulate in the God program, when I get multiple views, I get filters, I get data structure. So to me, the interesting project with aesthetics can we take these new interfaces with new conventions of representation, you know, which seem to emerge or seems to appropriate, you know, for information work and apply them to the realm of what we traditionally thought of as symbolic cultural representation.
Espen, and then Maggie and Lisa.
Yeah, just a quick comment. There is actually an interface, I don't know if you choose the interface you mentioned, based on the way you could do one of those things, but actually it is. Took all my thoughts away, so I just like to enter them very briefly. I think that approach of taking proper seriously is extremely important. But I have also a problem with this dichotomy between culture and software, as it seems to be in your various things. Computers have always been fun and cultural, therefore. All this comes from Sketchpad, as one of the first graphics programs. The first graphics program, actually, yeah, was Sketchpad, was Facebook, Google, in 1961. So there's, I don't see this as a development from the theory to the fun. Actually, probably the other way around, for me anyway. I started my presentation by saying that there's a crisis in the infrastructure space, and it would be nice, but very wrong to say, to put it off. I think because this conference is nice and interesting and useful as it has been, for me, certainly, just interested that there is such a crisis. And, I think we see it as both and already pointed out in the book, in the focus of the book, running through many of these presentations. Very interesting perspective. But it could also be seen as a way of repurposing magic, rather than actually discovering the importance of the new technologies, whatever they are, and we don't know it yet.
Okay, you know, it's not the devil, actually, but...
and I also think that, you know, to characterize at least my work, Kate's work, on the basis of these 25 minutes, I'm doing a book series, but I've done lots of stuff on other things, and I think that, you know, my next project is also around many of the issues. You know, I'm doing much more full-scale investigations about music, architecture, and contemporary fine art relate to the emergence of information and the way information finds form. And that's going to have to do with lots of different things. But I don't think that there's any reason that books per se can't be part of a transmedia investigation and also can't be the result of a transmedia. I mean, you've published books. I like books. I have nothing against it. Not only don't I have anything against books, I wanted to see what could be done to bring books into a new space, a space in, that magazines have occupied for 15 years.
Well, I think also to say that we should somehow leave books out of this discussion misses the point of medial ecology, misses the kind of exchanges that are going on between digital objects and books, books and digital objects. And that exchange is part of what is revitalizing the book as a physical object, but it also feeds back into digital objects as well to influence them. And I think it would be too bad to lose the whole dimension of that exchange just on the theory that we ought to look at digital objects in themselves. I think it's important to understand them in all of their digitality, but I also think that digitality is not evolving in isolation. It's evolving in a whole cultural context, part of which includes books.
Well, I just want to add more to the glory of a book. Is that, I mean, first of all, we can think of a book as simply a particular type of output, right, for new media. You know, so I can make a website, or I can make something else, or I can make a book. And the advantage of making a book is that there are only two types of cultural objects today, where the user is prepared to spend about 40 hours. It's 40 hours. It's a book and a computer game.
Yeah.
So it's a very quick way to actually get people to deal with, you know, some complex material.
Well, there's also this distributed phenomenon where cultural products appear in books and have websites associated with them, or websites that have books associated with them, so that the work is actually distributed across a variety of media. And there are already some interesting examples of that. I'm sure there will be more interesting examples of that. And one could certainly make the argument that if you wanted to understand the work, you then could not look at simply one of its media manifestations. You would have to look at all of its media manifestations, and the work, in fact, is a distributed product.
To follow up on what Kate's talking about, manifestations, there's a brilliant work of art right now at MoCA by Liz Larner. It's the opening of her her first career retrospective. Liz Larner is a sculptor based in Los Angeles. And what Liz did was she took a cube and rotated it in space in a computer animation software, took six keyframes, looked at those keyframes and started to arrange them in a way that the vertices started to expand out and intersect with each other. She then took that and made that computer data set manifest in the world. And it is that manifesting in the world, almost as high as the ceiling, that makes that an incredibly important digital object. And it's the way that it's painted, it's the physicality, and for me, it's the phenomenology of sculpture that she brings out. In other words, it is an unrepresented, and what Alan was talking about in terms of Turner and the Sublime, and then Lyotard and the unrepresentability of this sculpture in 2D. Right? There's no a slide will in effect ruin this piece. It will be less than mimesis. It will be, in essence, a sort of really bad. When it's repurposed, as it will be by art magazines, it's going to be just not important. As an object, as a physical manifestation, it's vital.
Okay, Maggie.
I'm trying to map your metaphor model onto remap it according to my background, which would be more like film than the eye. I'm thinking of Christian Metz's piece on the difference between metaphor and dream language. And a lot of the things you did, if I did my mapping, they would wind up being dream language, which would be the act of blending with things fired. So, for example, his example might be a teapot that's also a cat, or the actual clock fades for one image is a human pose or another. Which is some of the things like the vital or the realm, I would think would be definitely in that category. And then I think what would you, it's too fast for me to actually map them very well. So I'm not sure exactly how they measure what you would lose if you didn't have the distinction between conversation and placement, use the frame of green language, and the mapping over a signifier, which you would see more metaphor. It strikes me that you lose something and that it probably makes it more difficult to deal with ontological levels of materialization.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thought, how dream language would work with this. And I have to think more about that, but I would just say that the materialization of these metaphors into physical objects are coming from some source, and some of those sources might include unconscious sources, dream language, etc. So I don't see any reason why a physical object couldn't do the same sort of work that a dream image or dream language might do, but now materialized into physical form. Obviously, there's some conversation between those two realms.
Lisa?
I wanted to ask about the whole
certain
about the potentiality of computer technology. I mean, when we present our work,
encoding that we need to be able to think about humanity that's encoded too. And maybe it does involve shifting this course of thinking about work and labor and future ways of organizing ourselves so that we're really engaging in this interface.
I got some ideas about that, at least. That's a really good question here. I have two answers in particular to your question about how we might innovate in our work practices here based on the kinds of things we've been doing and talking about. The first answer is a kind of science fiction one. It's actually one that I draw my inspiration from George's project, Pocketful of Memories, with its self-organizing map algorithm running in the background, rearranging the mementos on that screen according to affiliations that are not human perceptible but perceptible to the machine in the background there. I once suggested to George that this might be an excellent way to organize a conference. That is, as it were, we set up a version of this installation here. The presenters come and scan in their papers. That's what they have in their pockets. And then the machine decides what the hidden affiliations are between the papers and creates the session groupings and so on. Then it's our task to decipher what the affiliations actually are there in the background. It's kind of a sci-fi version of an answer. The more realistic answer is this. I actually think that very strange and interesting and innovative things have been happening in a parliament of people and things like this that may be deceptive because it seems to be very old and not new, but actually has the effect of the new. One of the effects of working among a parliament of people and of things, all these apparatuses here that cause disruptions in our discourse, that cause us to break out of our linear written text, that cause us to improvise and innovate, is that an increasing amount of my time as a presenter is away from my written text, back to a very old model of oral presentation here. I'm a much looser speaker today than I was in the past when I up and I read my 14 pages of prepared script. I'm also a much looser speaker today than I was in the past because this kind of IT setting brings together people from different disciplines with different protocols for how you present a paper. There are engineers who would not be caught dead bringing in a prepared text. After all, it's dead knowledge there in some kind of surreal way. I'm a much better speaker now because I've managed to return to this very old technology of oral presentation in a way that is refigured and rewoven together with all the new technologies on top of it. The writing, the list form, for example, the list in a web page, etc. here. And in that regard, if I may address the issue of McKay envy, McKay envy here that is uploading here. Without too much empty boasting, there may be a little bit here, but it's certainly not foreign to the culture of oral mocking that Walter Ong, for example, writes about. Darn it, I think I'm as good a speaker as Kay, and all these people are here. It's not accidental that in his talk, his final paradigm for knowledge is the Sermon on the Mount. It goes back to the proverb. It goes back to the proverbial form of an aggregative, orally discovered knowledge which seems to come out of nowhere from this metaphor. The structure in the background, which is never manifest in terms of this metadata and metastructure, it simply pours it forth in seemingly random form, but in such a way that it amounts to a sermon on the mount. And if we can come back to that kind of point where we can intersect with the scientists and engineers and issue the same kind of discourse among our parliament of things, I'd be happy with that as an innovation.
Can I try to respond to this question? I mean, I think things like, you know, ThinkMap or, you know, various sophisticated technologies we saw in 3 days are fantastic, but I think the kind of the main issue with new forms of work and scholarly communication in the humanities is that the kind of units, right, the units of academic work which counts in American academia are the article in a peer-reviewed journal and the book. And this is why when it comes to talking about contemporary issue, you know, American academy is always like 5 to 10 years behind, right? Because by the time you write a book, by the time your book gets published, you know, you'll be like 10 years behind. And that's also, so the consequence is, this is one of the reasons why, you know, because I kind of want to follow new media arts, I have to go to Europe all the time, you know, where people are not afraid to put things online and you know, and participate in things like NetTime. As a result, discussion happens very quickly, and this is also one of the reasons why you know, scientists rule the contemporary world and humanities aren't, because scientists, you know, can work much quicker and much more effective because we don't have to wait for each other to publish a book of academic press. I mean, can you imagine a physicist, like each time you run an experimental laboratory, you have to go like to publish a book? I mean, when you get promotions in science, you know, you just publish articles. You know, articles are published like that. So to me, you know, it's not about fancy software. It's about simply using contemporary form of communication, which is things like email, web, mailing lists, as opposed to outdated form of scholarly communication, like books published by university press. I mean, MIT, you know, took me 15 months to get my book out on the new media, right? And they thought it was fast, or scholarly journals. You know, so it's basically being as up to date as a scientist. And so the way we're shooting, you know, I think I'm, you know, being in American academia, people are shooting themselves in the foot, you know, by not adapting these more modern methods. So we don't have to have sophisticated algorithms, you know. Web is email and mailing list is quite enough.
Let's see, Bill had a question and then Jeremy.
Just wanted to respond. I think I was the only panelist at this conference who's not from a research university. I think that I come out of the research university. There are wonderful things about the research university. I felt like I was in drag here, in a sort of academic drag. It's been 5 years since the last time I read from a text. I thought I'd do it, you know, to try it again, because I generally stand up. I have media in front of me, and I do that. And I am a huge believer in something that the megaversity makes impossible, which is the location of discourse and dialectic within place. Discourse and dialectic are completely riven to discipline. In other words, you have so much more in common with people at Wisconsin or with people in New York or with people somewhere else who are within your specific discipline than you do with your place. I think I've been lucky enough to live in Los Angeles, and for about 6 years I did something called Media Work, the Southern California New Media Working Group. And it was a working group. I took that title specifically from ULIPO, you know, the Working Group for Potential Literature, which was based in Paris. There were Italian and American members. Actually, there was one Italian and one American member. It was very French that way. But what they were able to do, and I think what I think is really important, is that you have to build a community, and often you have to build a community within a space. But that's different than, you know, just meeting an MLA or SCS or something like that, and then the occasional quote-unquote interdisciplinary meeting. You actually have to get together. I'm a big fan of booze. You know, people are much more interesting, or they seem more interesting, after you've had a drink at lunch. And that was great. Believe me, by 10:30 at night, everyone was a genius at dinner. me too. But I think that, you know, and part of that is about shifting from the paper to the demo. I thought that, you know, there wasn't much of a plenitude of visual pleasure or provocation at the start of this, and I think that in today's sessions, there was much more going on that white screen, and I think that that had something to do with the ability to move towards that. And objects are really important too. I should have had a stack of media work pamphlets, and there should have been even more artist books. Money comes into the production of objects, that's why there weren't. But if you have a small group of people and you bring them together, you can feel those objects touch them.
My version of the collaboration and the something desired around the conference said it has crucially to do with how you mix the old and the new. Now how you and of course we have the dominant ideology of the old and the new. They go back to the debate of France in the late 17th century. Between the ancients and the moderns, the ancients felt really truth resides in the ancient period, and it's our job of rolling lines to distract it. And then the new science, for the index and the conference, that I've never tried, insisted, no, you know, there are things going on in the present, and we're planning for the future that can locate truth here. And I think, you know, Marx's starting idea for this conference was that there are things in the past that could be used in making this thing. And the way I would put that in the old constructively, though, is not in this aim, you know, should we come to the ancients or the moderns? Neither ancients nor moderns, both ancients and moderns. And how do you do that? That's hard to do. And the question about the book as an interface, why you take the book, you know, in other words, an accusation of the modern to say, you know, why you stuck to the book. And so just to kind of give this a location, Lev knows I'm a great fan of the book, so I wanted to criticize one part of this presentation for you know, offering a kind of modern, overly modern way of narrating the difference between old and new. So when you use, you said, older conventions for data representation, access manipulation, equals culture, newer conventions for data representation, access manipulation, equals info access, immediately the suspicion is, aha, he's used a common modern info language to describe the older. In other words, that formulation doesn't sort of undertake the labor of transaction, of translation between old and new, and somehow accommodates to each other and make a difference of each. You know, a number of us talk about it. Esther talked about the difference of the computer and the number of people here. And so when you generate a list of terms for old and new, which you admit were problematic, form, information, immersion, interactivity, you know, immediately the listener says, okay, what's the good one of these? What's the hip one and what's the not so good? Or, you know, in other words, the deconstructive terms that apply hierarchy to opposition. Yeah. And one is into a more intuitive than the other. And so when you talk, for instance, about design database, and of course you want random access and where we but of course, you know, then the scholar comes along in the third, fourth century, and then the codex, and the advantage of the codex of the scroll. And you have all those perspectives in your book. But when you say different views of the same information, what about Rashomon? I mean, that's a film that's based on that desire, you know, different views. So in a way, we set this conference up in both senses of the word to be the modern conference, the last. Points towards the future, give us a supply vista, and then we have the history conference at the beginning. We probably should have done that, you know, but anyway, so that's the general question.
Object can be understood, you know, as a particular point in the multidimensional space described with a position. So it's actually not binary. So even though a computer is a binary on the hardware level, on the software level, in fact, it allows for kind of continuous multidimensional thinking, because every single object, every single notion can be represented, you know, as a point in a multidimensional space, and every dimension can be followed with a continuous. So to me, it's your computer gets us away from binary thinking.
Can I just briefly respond to that as well? I think this is a real problem for people who work on new technologies, not to fall into this dichotomizing and the hierarchic notion that the new is better and the old is bad. So I would just like to point out a couple of benefits of putting the old and the new in continuous conversation. The new allows the old to be reconceptualized and to be seen afresh without the assumptions that have traditionally categorized it. For example, Donald Merlin's book talking about cave paintings as external memory storage puts a fresh gloss on those that adds a new interpretive dimension, and at the same time to recognize a cave painting as a form of external memory storage forces claims about the new to be more specific and more historically contextualized. So I think there's a really important dynamic and tension between those two that really needs to continue in conversation.
Okay, great. Unless Jeremy was next, and you're coming up, Mark. Jeremy? Yeah.
I'll make this very brief. This is actually going back to recent parts of this. I wanted to mention also how I was happy to provide the technological interruptions that enabled the new laboratory pre-fabric to be conference. And I hope that that was useful to everybody. Seriously, one thing I wanted to say about work, specifically in structuring the work about things like this, a specific example from working in software development environment and in a QA department and then a product management position was when a lot of people were talking about Alan Kay was talking, and then there was the discussion about discourse between fields and more largely about interdisciplinarity, which that was one radical example. I thought, well, developers wait to get the spec, and then they build it. And so Philip Diffin gets really frustrated when he brings in a prototype, and then everyone gives these sort of disaster-related, really broad level critiques that don't help him at all as applying anything to him. But then, like, you know, because QA, you know, criticism, important thing. We all defend critical practice. It's vital. But then, and on our end, we have people asking us, well, how exactly do you want it to work? And we said, well, what we do is you make something, and then we tell you what's wrong with it. So the most worthless meetings I've ever been in my life were when the development department and the QA department got together before those things happened. Because the developers kept waiting to be told what to do, and the QA people kept waiting to something. I thought as a work model that might provide some sort of metaphor for the conversational disjunctions that happen in certain kinds of disciplinarity. And the thing that works for the companies I would think that helps you out of that is what people call brainstorming sessions, where you leave your department all together, which is the thing that I appreciated so much about so much of this conference. So that was
just
a general comment.
Okay, I see Warren and Mark and then Rita.
I don't think I have anything to say, but I just wanted to amplify on what Peter said in response to this question, and also I think what Kate Paper is really about. I used to be really suspicious of demos as a kind of production. And then I realized that there's a real change in the interaction that it engenders, which is if you're exchanging papers with one another, a lot of times the easy thing to do is criticize one another. And that might be critical or not, or it might just be like arguing with one another. But the thing that I think if we take this whole notion of a material metaphor really seriously,
think of the production of the object as something to be examined just as closely as the text or a presentation. My experience is that it changes a lot of stuff. If I make something, if I make a product, I can actually hand it off, and then I can say, play with it. But a demo is a lot of times, like, I make something and I say, let's play with it together. And that is the change in dynamic that I think is really useful, much more playful, and fun. And that it can produce critical ideas as well. So it really is a different interaction.
A brief add-on to that, I have a favorite sort of metaphor of mine that plays on the face idea as well. And so much of our traditional teaching is face-to-face in a sort of very claustrophobic way. So I talk to the student, student talks back, I give an exam, student writes back to me, that kind of circuit. When we're building a web page together now, or a project, or something that we can, as you put it, try to demo to the rest of the class or the rest of the world together, we're no longer face-to-face, we're shoulder-to-shoulder looking at this thing that other people are looking at us through. And while we may decry the loss of face-to-face contact because of the interface, it also allows for a kind of shoulder-to-shoulder contact, which has its own merits and own a value supplementing our normal humanities mode of working.
One way to think about that is to expand out of the sort of psychoanalytic model that was brought up in one of the questions earlier. And, you know, talk about your mechanical metaphors, right? It's basically a steam engine notion of how the mind works, compression, you know, explosion. I'm not quite sure how the mother fits together with that, but pistons and rods, I don't know. But what can be interesting about a demo is this notion that there is, you know, obviously your dynamic consciousness, which is driving the demo. There's the psychoanalytic notion of the dynamic unconscious. But what you bring in with this technology is the dynamic non-conscious, which is what that machine is for all of Alan or anybody else's endless blither blather about artificial intelligence. It's still a dynamic non-conscious. And I think that that creates this really interesting triangulation to get us out of a certain kind of, for me, 20th century exhaustion with the psychoanalytic problem. Right? And that it adds a new piece to that puzzle. And I think that it's precisely the fact that when you teach students to do demos, one of the things I start with is make sure that whatever presentation you can do in the dark, right? That there has to be some sort of default so that not only does the machine not work, but all the electricity's off and the doors and windows are closed and it's just you, right? You have to evoke something. That's where Steve Jobs is the demo god, right? Because he is the Luftmensch. He can make you believe something with his hands and with his voice, just him in front of you. And the famous reality distortion effect, right? You come near him, reality distorts, you just believe him. And so that's the mark of a great demo. Whether or not we want to have the... What? What? Oh, no, thank you. But I wasn't with him. If I'd been with him, I would have said, yeah, all those time-wasting animations, that's a great idea. But, I don't know. Nothing is fast enough.
Mark and Rita, then I think we should probably wind it up.
I want to actually kind of spread that I believe the partner and build it up and in part talk about what we were trying to do here. And I think that's also what was based in how we set this up. At one of the first dinners here, I can't remember who I was talking with, I was talking about an earlier conference from Microsoft and one of the which was about a model of history, and particularly about this sort of three-level model of idea of starting off with the historical and then moving on actually sort of complicated this literacy model and led to another discussion that we have. And I suggest that the relationship between old and new, between culture and information and all this is vastly more complex in some ways and vastly simpler even than the slavery and that same form.
Does anybody want to respond to that?
No? Do you have any clay foodies right now? I'm getting kind of peckish. No. Especially
if
I'm... Rita. I have another question for you about the relationship between content and presentation. And I wonder if it's useful to think about a content that is totally separate from or has no relation whatsoever to presentation. And I'm thinking about monstrosity as a sort of step beyond allogenesis, which is the new that's totally strange or unfamiliar. But monstrosity exists only as potential because it can never be. If it comes into being, it's going to be tamed and domesticated. So its threat or its subversive power is always going to be unrealized. It can never emerge. So I was thinking about where the place of monstrosity would be within your schema, you know, kind of aesthetic ideology or how it would fit in. I mean, essentially, I mean, it's just I'm confusing my terms here, but in a way, you know, like maybe the more radical content would be that which has no interface at all.
It's a very rich question, and to tie together with the previous conversation, of course, the word demo from demonstration comes from de monstrare, which we mean to monster forth or to show etymologically here. What I talk about as a transcendental data, as a transcendental data source or data core or data flood is a monstrous thing. It's a god or a monster, so it's one of the two. It is in and of itself not imaginable or presentable. It can only be demoed in our weak sense of a superficial, reductive rendering of something that in and of itself has no face. We may recur to our original metaphor for this conference here. And that's why it is when you do serious artistic and literary efforts to represent that kind of data for, as I call it, it comes out looking monstrous. That's why that passage in William Gibson's Neural Method that I cited is a kind of chimera or a hybrid monster that is being described here, with random access parts that are not assembled together. That's the kind of image that, you know, Shelley Jackson produces for us in her Patchwork Girl. That's ultimately the image that this new literary history that I cited is producing for us under the disguised comfort of a very comparable old patchwork quilt. I think what a lot of contemporary art, both sonic and visual and otherwise, is about this kind of assembled chimera hybrid experience of something that innately has no structure and has no form and no design, but which we need to see in a form and in design. And as good a name as any for that kind of monstrous god now is information.
Can I ask a little quick question? Well, I really enjoyed your talk both in form and the content and, you know, kind of if I think any meaning to a word kind of demo or cultural software, right? What I was wondering is I'm not completely convinced about your choice of terms, which is data extraction and also idea of presentation, because when I think of data extraction, I think of data mining. But maybe I wonder if what you were talking about is actually more like filtering. Right. I mean, if I have my email program, you know, I can basically filter, so I can only look at, you know, this message as opposed to that messages. So, because extraction really is sort of, it's like going to the dentist, you know, a little bit. And then, again, when you're talking about presentation, I mean, why not talk about the interface? Because, of course, you know, I mean, with a lot of interfaces, you have your data, and you can show it, you can present it, you know, in a variety of different ways. So I wonder if your terms will maybe a little bit too specific to, you know, a particular kind of database things you were using as examples. So, you know, this is a more general thing.
Yeah, they need to be thought through, you know, because there are ideological, social, and other implications behind them. The term content versus presentation, I'm pulling pretty much directly out of the normal discourse of text encoding communities here. That's pretty much standard, so that's where I'm starting from.
Okay.
The term extraction is mine. I think you're quite right that it has implications that I'm not quite aware of. I kind of like it, though, because I like the painful implications of the dental extraction. You are taking something that is rooted, if we may refer back to the tree of life, organically embodied in the material existence, and you are extracting it from its living context. That is what this kind of extraction is for, to be able to take that part of a worker's working process, which is why I like presentation rather than product as a concept in the process. Take it out of its organic context in modular form so that you can, as it were, sample it, to redistribute it, reprogram it here. But I take your point that the term data extraction, as in data mining, has other uses.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, I can recommend my dentist, and it's very pleasurable. So,
okay.
Well, speaking of extraction,
yes.
I don't know,
you
gave us a petition that is probably
I will send less talk.
Can I just ask us all, since I've been trying to be increasingly alert to the implications of materiality, to thank everyone who did all the material work on putting together this conference.
Thank you. But let us, can we also thank, the organizers, the conceptual organizers, for this wonderful event.